So you're running out of closet space. The good news? You don't need to stop shopping. You just need to start selling with The RealReal. The RealReal is the world's largest and most trusted resource for authenticated luxury resale. Whether it's that mini bag that can't even fit your phone, or those boots you never fully broke in, The RealReal handles everything from photography and copywriting to shipping and pricing. So you can just sit back, get paid, and make room for things that actually feel like you. And with 10,000 plus new arrivals every single day from top designers like Prada, Celine, Louis Vuitton, and Loewe, all for up to 90% off retail, you're bound to find something perfectly on brand to fill that extra closet space with. Plus, right now, you can get an extra $100 to shop when you sell for the first time. Make room for what feels like you. Go to TheRealReal.com to start selling and get your extra $100 to keep shopping at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
This episode was recorded for my UK column show. Please keep us independent by going to support.ukcolumn.org.
This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
The thing we're going to talk about is something I've been working on for many years, quietly, and I published on it because I was leaving the field. And the way I phrased it was, as I sort of opened the door to leave, before I let it close, I lobbed a hand grenade in behind me and then let the door close. And it caused one hell of a stir when I did. You know,
my favourite kind of stir.
Yeah, and unfortunately, as you alluded to last time, this is going to disappoint a lot of damsels in distress, isn't it?
Are you telling me that there won't be a knight in shining armor, Chris?
Yes. Is that the end of the podcast now?
All right. Thank you for joining me in the trenches.
It's been lovely. See you again.
I don't think I've ever spoken to somebody with your skill set. So just quickly, what is your bio?
Right. I was retired now. A master armourer, the first master armourer in England since the 17th century to have their mastership recognised. And an armourer isn't, not in the modern sense of the word, an armourer as in somebody who makes suits of armour or pieces of armour. And I did that for four decades, started off by making pieces and then began restoring pieces and working at the highest levels. So, it always was a highly specialised craft. This isn't something that back in the Middle Ages blacksmiths did. It was absolutely banned. It was a specialised craft here in Italy of armourers and swordsmiths. And it was so specialised, even in Germanic states, for example, armourers had to be qualified to make individual pieces one after the other. You couldn't just, you're qualified so you can make a whole armour. You could be qualified to make helmets or gauntlets or breastplates and so on. So I came to that after what you might call an interesting childhood and something I didn't tell you before, and that is I'm the son of a Bletchley Park codebreaker. That was Station X.
Say that again. A what?
My father worked at somewhere known during World War II as Station X, which was at Bletchley Park, and that was where they broke the German Enigma codes with the first computers.
Would you say Bletchley Park? Where's that?
Yeah, I think it's just to the south of London. It's a stately home. It's now a museum. And it was absolutely top secret during the war. And that was where they built the first computers to crack the Enigma code, which they did. Well, without derailing the podcast, he was more than that. He was a Royal Naval officer. He was a lieutenant or sub-lieutenant. And I work in archives, as the listeners are going to hear very shortly, and I tried finding him in the British military archives, and he's not there. He's just invisible.
Oh, wow.
And
persona non grata.
No, it's probably what's called a denotice. He's just been officially vanished because whatever he was doing was too sensitive. He didn't talk about this during his lifetime. And after he died, we found out from my aunt, who's also gone now, that he was in France 3 days ahead of D-Day, ahead of the invasion. So whatever he was up to, it was secret stuff.
That is insane.
Mm-hmm. And never said a word about it. We found out a lot.
So the only thing I know about it is from that movie. It's that big machine where they do basically a series of switches of ones and zeros until they can eventually figure out what's been communicated. That's kind of correct, isn't it?
Yeah. One thing I do know about my father is he took one of the first Enigma machines off the Germans himself. He was on a ship in the Mediterranean, and they took the U-boat U-571, and that had the Enigma machine on board.
Sure. Wow. Okay, so your father had a fascinating history, and so do you. What's next?
What's next is from him I got the love of history. And, you know, as a kid, I got into wargaming, military modeling, all that sort of thing. My first job was working in a shop selling model soldiers. And then in 1985, I graduated up to full-size ones, as I put it. I'd always played around with metal at school and my father's workshop, self-taught, I have to stress. And I just had this crazy idea in 1985 that I was going to set up a studio to actually start reconstructing armor. And I did.
Right. And you were saying earlier that a few centuries ago, when people made armor, they only made certain parts of the full piece. You do the entire thing.
Yeah. I mean, Italian armorers could do the entire thing. The guilds had different systems in different countries. But often this, as I think I mentioned to you before, the specialization of the crafts at the time was to ensure that the quality of the work would be absolutely top notch. So in Brescia in the 16th century, we know it took 12 people to make a sword. So you had a different craftsman was the bladesmith who actually made the blade. Someone else would make pieces of the hilt. Someone else would make the scabbard. Someone else would carry out decoration. Someone else would engrave the blade, and on and on and on. So it was incredibly specialized work.
And you do the job of all of those people?
With regard to armor, yeah. And I have produced edged weapons as well. I also then, from the making point, and this is what's going to lead on to the subject of today, from making armor, I then went on to restoring it. I began to pick up collectors who would bring me broken pieces of armor and say, can you make a new piece for this to match it? And then it happened with antiques dealers as well, and then museums. And by the end of 40 years, I was working for the top museums in the world, top collectors in the world, working on armor that had been made for kings and emperors. Just incredible privilege to work on stuff at that level.
Because I mean, it's incredibly niche.
Yes. It's not something I mentioned to the school's career officer before I left school. Not the sort of thing it's not a career path people would normally take. But there are other armourers and swordsmiths out there now. You know, there are people still making, and that is, I suppose, what leads.
So you're running out of closet space. The good news? You don't need to stop shopping. You just need to start selling with The RealReal. The RealReal is the world's largest and most trusted resource for authenticated luxury resale. Whether it's that mini bag that can't even fit your phone or those boots you never fully broke in, The RealReal handles everything from photography and copywriting to shipping and pricing. So you can just sit back, get paid, and make room for things that actually feel like you. And with 10,000 plus new arrivals every single day from top designers like Prada, Celine, Louis Vuitton, and Loewe, all for up to 90% off retail, you're bound to find something perfectly on brand to fill that extra closet space with. Plus, right now, you can get an extra $100 to shop when you sell for the first time. Make room for what feels like you. Go to TheRealReal.com to start selling and get your extra $100 to keep shopping at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
Just on to the subject of the podcast, which is what armor actually looked like and why the idea of the knight in shining armor is a complete myth.
Yes, but I mean, everything we're chatting about kind of creates context because, you know, these are the things that people don't even think about. What you do can technically be done with machines.
Yes, and I'm sure somebody out there is trying to get a 3D printer to produce pieces of armor, I'm sure. But that's not how they were made originally, obviously. And the skill that went into making them originally was quite phenomenal. And it's worth saying now, if people have got this horrible idea from Hollywood and the TV that armor was heavy and that weapons went through it and it was cumbersome. And of course it wasn't. It was protective clothing for professional warriors. It was extremely expensive to make. And if it didn't work and it had hindered their fighting, they wouldn't have used it. This is something that surprises a lot of people. Armor was proofed. An armor of proof means they would complete an armor and then shoot at it with the most powerful ballistic weapons of the day, which would mean bows, crossbows, and firearms. And you'll often see in museums late 16th and 17th century breastplates, which have got dents in them here on the sides at the top. Nice round dent from a musket ball. And that's because they stood it up on a dummy at 30 yards and shot it to prove that, so that it worked. And I've handled pieces that have gone through what you might call really hot action. A breastplate I worked on for a client, very, very dear friend now gone. It was covered in not proof marks. It was proof marked. It was covered in marks from bullets. And it had been stabbed by something like a pike or a halberd, and it had sword cuts across it. So whoever wore that was right in the thick of it.
And what if I shot my 9mm or hunting rifle at it?
Ah, that's different. Much higher velocity.
Okay, so the bullets will go through. So they will go through.
Modern high velocity stuff will go through it. Yeah. And so now we're going to lead on to another little interesting bit of context you didn't know before either. And that is, I've made modern armour, anti-ballistic modern armour, for the police in the UK. I don't know if they ever went into production. I sold the design to them. And as part of that, I mean, I know you like your guns, and you don't know that I've shot guns as well with the Met Police Royal Protection Squad. So I had to make a combination armour made of titanium plate and Kevlar. And we shot, I was given a 357 Magnum to shoot at it and a 44 Magnum with Magnum ammunition. And
were you able to shoot them while standing and not losing your balance?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. But a hell of a kick.
Well done.
Absolutely hell of a kick.
Yes, well done.
Yeah. And we were going through different designs, and it has to be said, a lot of the time, the bullet went straight through the armor, out the other side, and was still asking where the armor was. You know, just straight through.
Yeah, I'm
incredibly
sure.
Powerful.
Well, I don't know if you can see this, but I shot this.
Yes.
This is a 50 mil.
Yeah, 50 cal. Wow.
It was a BMG. So I beg your pardon, 50 cal BMG that I shot. And yes, the crazy thing, right? I mean, that thing is designed to take out, you know, vehicles at a long way away. The recoil was almost non-existent.
Really?
There was a coffee cup on the table to the side of me, and it blew off the table.
Wow. So that was what, a sort of shockwave going laterally?
So for the longest time in history, armor was used, and it was used effectively.
Yeah, it worked. Yeah. And
tell me a bit about the weight, though. I mean, so you would think right off the bat that having thick armor is better.
Depends what it's made of. Armor was originally made of iron, and then they moved on to making armor out of steel. and then they began to heat treat.
Iron, you wouldn't be able to walk with iron.
Well, yeah. In fact, early armor is one way you can easily spot fakes. If you handle early pieces from the 14th and early 15th century, they're heavy. Helmets are heavy because they were using an inferior material. And for the listeners who don't know, the difference between iron and steel is that steel has a carbon content and it's got to be above 0.3, 0.4%. After that, you can heat treat it to harden it. Below that, doesn't matter how many times you heat it up and quench it in oil or water, you're not going to harden it at all. So that's what they did. They moved from an inferior material to a superior material, so they were getting lighter, and then they began to heat treat it, and once they could do that, it could become lighter again.
Okay, so Chris, you said you made armor and then you restored it, but I just want to make sure that I'm following you absolutely correctly. When you say you make or made armor, was it all by hand? You did it with the forge, the whole kind of blacksmith route?
Yes, absolutely. The concessions to modernity were using power shears to cut up the sheets of metal, as opposed to using a hammer and chisel or using massive manual shears, which they used to have. So I would do things like that. But other than that, yes, it was all hammers and specialized anvils that are called stakes. And you have different shapes, like a sort of big mushroom shape for working a breastplate over, a ball shape for raising up helmet skulls. And then you would have things like half moon shapes for working the comb of a helmet in or embossed decoration in. So I had hundreds of them. I actually acquired a lot of originals from a company who were closing down, ironically, near where I lived in Colchester in England. And they had a lot, and some of them came from the Royal Armouries in Greenwich. So some of the tools I was using were originals from the 16th century.
And how long would it take you?
Me on my own, months. But that's not how it was done originally. In the 15th century, they had a military industrial complex just like now. And the center of armor production in Europe through the 14th and 15th century was the city of Milan in northern Italy. And they had hundreds of armorers working with journeymen. So you would be qualified as a master, but then there was a lesser stage, which was being a journeyman. And they would journey from workshop to workshop to work for masters. And then below them, you had apprentices. So there were hundreds of armourers working in Milan, and they were producing thousands of armours every year. So it's a huge output. Well, you even had people specialised in making buckles or hinges. We know that from their names. There's a fellow called Giovanni delle Fibbie, recorded in Milan in the 15th century, and Fibbie are buckles. So that was John who made buckles.
So you're running out of closet space. The good news? You don't need to stop shopping. You just need to start selling with The RealReal. The RealReal is the world's largest and most trusted resource for authenticated luxury resale. Whether it's that mini bag that can't even fit your phone or those boots you never fully broke in, The RealReal handles everything from photography and copywriting to shipping and pricing. So you can just sit back, get paid, and make room for things that actually feel like you. And with 10,000 plus new arrivals every single day from top designers like Prada, Celine, Louis Vuitton, and Loewe, all for up to 90% off retail, you're bound to find something perfectly on brand to fill that extra closet space with. Plus, right now, you can get an extra $100 to shop when you sell for the first time. Make room for what feels like you. Go to TheRealReal.com to start selling and get your extra $100 to keep shopping at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
That was his name. That's a career for you. So you were going to...
So in the medieval era, was being a blacksmith like this a frowned upon job, or was it a very elite position to have?
There you go, using the B word again.
Wait. Okay, hang on. Let's quickly deal with that. Blacksmith, there's a whole context here, isn't there?
Yes. No, I'm not and never was a blacksmith. Blacksmiths make wrought iron work. And here's another little curveball for you. In America in the 18th century, there were also whitesmiths. So blacksmiths would make stuff which would be black from the hammer with the scale from the forge left on it for outdoor use. And whitesmiths would make much finer pieces which would be polished white for use inside the house. But in my context, no, I was specifically an armourer. And in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, if blacksmiths tried producing armour, it would have been illegal. The guilds closed them down very quickly. Some of the guilds had what was called rights of search, which means you could get your door kicked down in the middle of the night and agents of the guilds would come in and examine everything in your home, which would, because they normally lived over the shop. So, you know, they were very strict about it.
So they were the equivalent to the SWAT team.
Yes,
in the States.
Yes, a Tudor SWAT team. Yes.
FBI. But,
yeah, something like that, yes. Incidentally, just to draw a few more parallels for the listeners, the people who were using this stuff, I mentioned the military-industrial complex, and in Italy, the mercenaries were called condottieri. And so you have a massive arms industry making swords, lances, daggers, crossbows, bows, making armour, and they're supplying professional armies, which are private. And as a curious parallel with today, the word condottiere means contractor. So in just the same way that today we have private military contractors, that's exactly what they had in the 14th, 15th and 16th centuries.
So nothing's changed.
No. No. In fact, I deal with this in my next book. We can perhaps mention at the end about three paintings about the Battle of San Romano. And I demonstrate the whole setup in that book in identifying three paintings, which are of people in armour. I actually demonstrate how the whole thing worked, how the setup to produce the armour and how it was then supplied to the troops, how the troops used it. Because also martial arts were used here in the West as well. It's not an Oriental thing. There are military manuals from the 15th century. A fellow called Fiore dei Libri from North Italy, and he wrote a famous book called The Flower of Battle. So the idea of particular poses, arm locks, holds, blows with swords, blows with pole axes, it was all codified. So these were not people lumbering around in really heavy armor, you know, just swiping at each other with big, heavy weapons. These were trained killers, and they were wearing the best protection the armorers could make for them.
And if you're going to be agile, you would need to wear something light.
Yeah. So they were expected to be able to turn a cartwheel in their armor without their helmet on. And they were also expected to be able to vault into the saddle without using the stirrups. So
that must be tricky.
Mm. Yeah, the idea of knights being craned into the saddle is something that comes from a Victorian comic opera. And it's also a sort of folk memory of armour as being very heavy at the end of its production, because by then firearms were getting so effective in the 17th century, armour did have to get very, very thick. And they'd gone back to iron by then. And they were actually using it because it was softer than steel, and so the iron plates would soak up the kinetic energy of the projectiles, almost like having a crumple zone built into a car. So it was better to have your armor distort and let a musket ball flatten out on it than be rigid and let the musket ball punch straight through it.
What breaks my brain, though, is when you told me previously that there was no shining armor. Knights in shining armor is a myth.
Yeah, almost none. So little as to be vanishingly small as an amount. And so this comes back to the heat treatment thing, segues nicely from the heat treatment thing. When they made armor in the forge, obviously you shape the thing and it leaves you with fire scale on it. Think of wrought iron railings. And that would be useful as weatherproofing. Because now we come to the reality of being out in all weathers, fighting, marching, riding, having to set up camp. And you do this in all weathers, at all times of the year. And if you have a nice, bright, shiny armour, what do you think is going to happen to it? It's going to rot. And we have a document from the 17th century, a guy called Gervase Markham, who was a professional soldier, and he helpfully lists the finishes on armour for us. I'll just quote him briefly. And he describes one colour which is russet, another one which is sanguine, another one which is black, and finally white or milled armour. In other words, armour which has been polished or the surface milled off it. And he actually says, all this armour is to be rather of russet, sanguine or black colour than white or milled, for it will keep the longer from the rust. So there you've immediately got a period document telling us a big reason why they would do this, because this was weatherproofing. So it didn't just rust to hell. The other reason, though, is as we move on to steel, as I explained, you heat treat the armour to improve the quality of the metal, the defensive properties. And if you do that, you've got to heat the armour up first and then cool it down quickly. So you heat it and you quench it. And the colour that Markham describes as russet, and there are lots of documents that talk about the russeting of armour, it's the reddening. It comes from the French word russe, russus, red. So it, from the Latin. So it's describing heating the armour up to a red colour, and then the Italians would just wait, say a quick Hail Mary, and then plunge it into a bath of oil. And what that did was, it was called slack quenching. So it was a form of hardening, but not too much in all one go. They didn't then have to retemper it afterwards. And it left the armour with this grey colour. So one process does two things. One, it hardens it, but not too much. And two, it gives it a protective coating against, you know, rain, humidity, that sort of thing. And that's what most armour was covered.
Yeah, but okay, so then where does this whole knight in shining armor thing come from?
Right. Well, it comes from collecting, largely. By the time armor was going out of use, ironically, there are more examples of white armor, because what I did in the book about the color finishes on armor, I started with what we know, because there are far more pieces of late 16th and 17th century armour that survive in collections, and also lots more documents, because the further back you go in time, it's a tiny proportion of what was originally made, largely because a lot of early armour was cannibalised by armourers. They would flatten it, cut it up, and then forge it into something new, because the material was extremely expensive to make. So we have these polished pieces. And then later on, as these pieces pass into museums, and particularly in private collections, in big stately homes in the UK, it was all the rage to have a nice display of polished armour on the wall. So armours that had got as far as the 17th century with their original colour finishes intact, and in one particular case, pieces in an Italian museum made it right up into the early 20th century with their original colour finishes still intact. And then an English antiquarian went along and said, oh, yeah, let's clean those up. And they boiled them in oil to get rid of what was left. And then that wrecked the colour finishes. And when they moved into a restoration workshop in Florence in the 1970s, they finished the job off. And those armours, which are wonderful, are in a museum now in North Italy, and they're all white. And this sort of thing went on across the board. So originally it was the taste of antiquarians. It even started in the 18th century with big collections like the Imperial Armoury in Vienna. We know the Empress Maria Theresa issued an edict that the armours in the armoury should get cleaned up. You know, so they went in and started polishing them up. So and then what happens is this gets embedded in Hollywood. It gets embedded in romances like Sir Walter Scott, others, People then begin just romanticizing it, that these were knights in shining armor. They must have been. And the Victorian English painters start producing paintings of knights in shining armor as well. And then you get TV and Hollywood, and it just gets hammered home again and again and again.
But, I mean, if we're honest with ourselves, shiny armor is prettier to look at.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I freely admit, hand on heart, I thought that was the case when I started making the stuff, you know, because this is not some grand conspiracy theory. You know, there hasn't been some intergenerational plan to hide the fact that most armor was never polished. That's not the case. It's simply just fallen out this way, that people have romanticized the idea of the knight in shining armor, and it never was the case. Now, what I did to start unpicking this whole puzzle was, when I was working on armor, I began looking at Italian art as a form of reference, because paintings, engravings, drawings, they can be extremely useful, because artists would often show religious scenes, for example, set in the present day. So they have Roman soldiers around the crucifixion are dressed like contemporary 14th, 15th and 16th century soldiers. So they're great documents for us to look at armor. And I was looking at these paintings, and in time I fell in love with the paintings for their own sake, and that's what I work on now, is art history. And you see the armors in these paintings are colored. And a lot of people have simply interpreted this in two ways. They say, well, either that's how the artist meant to depict polished steel. You know, if it's blue, that's the sky reflected in the surface of the metal. Or they say, oh, well, the painting's discolored. You know, that armor that's very dark in that painting, the pigments must have changed color. So it was originally much brighter and now it's darker. Now, what I did was I put my work on Italian art and European art together with what I began to find on the armors themselves when I worked on the original thing. And when I was taking original armors apart, I began to find traces of colour absolutely everywhere. Because if you take two plates apart that have been held together with rivets for centuries, no one's had a chance to clean between them. So you get armours which are in a stately home or a museum now, and they're polished white. But if you get a chance to take them apart, even if you remove a rivet and you can see underneath where the rivet was, you see a little halo of the original surface finish. And again, you find colours everywhere. And these colours are this grey colour everywhere, pale blue, the beautiful sky blue colour, dark blue, and the real classic, which is called peacock blue or sanguine, and that's purple. It's a bright, livid purple colour. So I was finding those colours which matched perfectly with the paintings. So what I then did was I began to look at period documents, and you get the descriptions of these colours. You get descriptions of azzurra, which means pale blue, or black, or sanguine, or blu di pavone, a peacock blue, or bronzed. And they're actually describing the colours that I was finding on the original armour and that you see in paintings. And in the inventories, the vast majority of pieces listed are all coloured. White pieces.
How did they create those colours?
Well, I explained russeting is by heating up and slack quenching. If you use slightly different temperatures, if you go higher in the colour range, and these are temper colours, tempering is you heat a piece of steel up fully red and quench it, and that's what's called glass hard. It's very hard, but it's brittle. And I tested that once. I got a piece of carbon steel, quenched it to make it glass hard, and then smacked it on the anvil and it shattered like a piece of glass. So what you need to do is temper the steel. And tempering means you clean off the surface so you can see it. It's white at this stage, and then you begin to heat it up again. And it goes through a series of colours from yellow to brown to purple to dark blue to light blue, and then it goes grey, and then you go into the red range. And you then re-quench when you reach the desired color. So, for example, something like a scalpel blade or what the Americans would call a box cutter blade or a Stanley knife in the UK, it's very brittle because it's been heated up to what we call a yellow or straw temper, and then it's been re-quenched. And hence the thing I mentioned before, this is why we get the expression losing your temper, because you break when you lose your temper. So if a thing isn't well-tempered, the metal could go.
Oh, I'm following. And then if you want to stay on that color, you quench it.
Mm-hmm. It freezes it. And
right.
That's why this heat treatment could produce pale blue armor, azzurro.
So you're running out of closet space. The good news? You don't need to stop shopping. You just need to start selling with The RealReal. The RealReal is the world's largest and most trusted resource for authenticated luxury resale. Whether it's that mini bag that can't even fit your phone or those boots you never fully broke in, The RealReal handles everything from photography and copywriting to shipping and pricing. So you can just sit back, get paid, and make room for things that actually feel like you. And with 10,000 plus new arrivals every single day from top designers like Prada, Celine, Louis Vuitton, and Loewe, all for up to 90% off retail, you're bound to find something perfectly on brand to fill that extra closet space with. Plus, right now, you can get an extra $100 to shop when you sell for the first time. Make room for what feels like you. Go to TheRealReal.com to start selling and get your extra $100 to keep shopping at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
And dark blue armor. And if you wanted armor to be black, that was another step afterwards. You could slack quench a piece of armor, coat it in oil, and then, or even fully harden it, and then you burn the oil off. You heat it up in the forge, and you burn the oil off, and it blackens it. And that's a known technique used by also by blacksmiths.
That's fascinating, Chris. So what you're saying is the color of the armor wasn't only for aesthetics, but it also indicated the strength.
Yeah. Oh, it's like what people used to call a kite mark. You know, a certification of quality. Because when most armor was russet grey, a family in Augsburg called the Helmschmieds began to fully harden and temper armor. And they left the temper color on to demonstrate it was a superior quality. And this was the peacock blue. And what they would do is they would heat, I know because I've done this, they would heat the armor up to red and then quench it. So it's then very hard, but it's brittle. And what you then do is you clean off the surface and you heat it up to go through the purple range. So it just as it's going from purple to blue, that's when you then quench it in water. And you've really got to arrest it firmly. So it's cold water. Now, at that point, you've got a great finish. It's this livid color, quite blue in the water. But the problem is the last thing you want is moisture on the surface, because if you leave it there, although you've given it a color oxide finish, it will start to corrode because there is water there. So you then transfer it to a bath of boiling water. So you're bringing the temperature up slowly. And then you transfer it to a bath of boiling oil. So not for the faint-hearted, these processes. And what the oil does is it drives off any remaining moisture, and it just saturates the whole thing, and that's it. That's the end of the process. You then take it out and you let it cool, and you have this absolutely livid purple-coloured armour. And that would be the mark of quality, because that's why the Helmschmieds knew somebody wearing one of their armors, which would be a hell of a striking thing to see. When most armor was gray, you've got somebody wandering around in this absolutely livid purple armor. And it's not just beautiful to see, and it could be combined with etched decoration and gilding as well, but also you would simply know by looking at it that that was a superior quality product.
But there's also a psychology. I mean, if an army was stampeding towards you and they're all in this sort of dark, murky gray armor, that would certainly be a lot more threatening than if they were all wearing a camp pink armor.
True, true.
In fact, if they were coming at you in a camp pink armor, you know it's a party, and they're most likely coming to redecorate the castle.
Yes, they're going to check. come along with some nice soft furnishings. Yeah. In fact, there's a TV show I love about what's called the Home Guard here in the UK, which were the veteran soldiers they used as a sort of reserve force during World War II. And it's a brilliant BBC sitcom. And one of the expressions the commanding officer uses is Nancy boys. And it works perfectly. These pink armors. Bunch of Nancy boys.
But I can imagine if the armor was perhaps a peacock blue or some sort of sky blue, that would look more elite.
Yeah, I'll quote a little document. There was when you look at white
or armor, even white would look elite. Yeah, white right. would also look well, very there, prestigious.
There comes a point where we have to look at why there was some white armor. Because there was, undoubtedly, very small amounts early on, and then it does seem to come in as a more general fashion as armour is going out of use. But there was a mercenary company led by an Englishman called Sir John Hawkwood, fighting for Florence in the 14th century. And he was commander of a company called the White Company. And it was assumed for many years that this was because the English men-at-arms were wearing white armour. And in fact, no, because the actual description of them from the time by a fellow called Villani, he says that every one of them had one or two pages or even more as befitted their status. And when they'd removed their arms, and the said pages were immediately ready to keep them clean, so that when they joined in battle, their arms seemed like mirrors. And for this reason, they were more intimidating. So that is an example of highly reflective armour, yes, being more intimidating. But what Villani doesn't say is they polished it. He says they kept it clean. And what we see in Italian paintings in this period is this pale blue colour. And it is very shiny because it's similar to the peacock blue. You don't wind up with this thick grey oxide on it. The oxide looks more like a coloured lacquer. So the light goes through the oxide, bounces off the polished surface of the steel or iron underneath, and comes back out again. And then what the eye sees is the interference pattern created by the oxide layer, which in this case is pale blue. So, yeah, they would have looked incredible. In a period where most people had this russet grey, they would have looked very different.
Mm. If the armour were shiny, wouldn't that have been strategically better, though? I mean, it would be off-putting to your enemy.
Makes you an excellent target as well.
Yes, of course, right, because the light's bouncing off you and then you can be seen. Yeah. Yes, I suppose.
Well, there's something, I mean, where we have records of white armour, there is a specific reason for it being worn. And we see it used in combination of saints in paintings. It seems to be a thing of purity, something called the, I'll get it right, the Knights of Christ. There's, for example, a painting by Jan and Hubert van Eyck called the Ghent Altarpiece, and it shows St. George, some other saints, and they are Militis Christi. They are the Knights of Christ, and they do have this absolutely white polished armour. Now, the interesting thing is sometimes you can spot white armour or other differences in the colour of armour in paintings, because one of the giveaways in a painting is you can get soldiers wearing different or armour with different colour finishes, you know, grey and black or pale blue and grey. And this is one of the things which defeats the argument that, no, it was originally white, the painting's just discoloured. Well, if the painting had discoloured, all of the armour would have discoloured the same way. So that's one thing that tells us that you have different colour finishes. But there was a document which could, it's an Iberian document, Spanish Peninsula. It could go back as far as the 14th century. It certainly goes back to the 15th century. And it's called Amadis of Gaula. And it's a very interesting, you know, snapshot. And I'm going to have to, here we are, found the document, of why they wore white armour. Because in this document, it states specifically, this is Amadis speaking, and I considered it a boon, and I told him I would take the horse because it was very good, and the cuirass and the helmet, but that the other arms were to be white, as is befitting for a novice knight. Right? These are not battle-hardened warriors. This is like a Sandhurst uniform before you go into action in your proper battle fatigues. And he then repeats it. He said, then at this hour, there arrived Gandalin and Isando, squire of Don Brunco, both wearing white armour as befitted novice knights. So he's stating specifically that white armour is used for squires and novices, not for experienced warriors. We also then get a wonderful painting, that what's called the double portrait of Federico de Montefeltro and his son Guidobaldo in 1474. And he is shown completely in white armour. And he at the time was setting himself up as a sort of almost like a paladin, a leader of the Christian faith. And there was talk of a crusade again to free Constantinople from the Turks. And he said, he wrote a letter to Lorenzo de' Medici in which he said he wanted to be purer than the candle of the Virgin Mary. And so there he is in this, you know, this pure white armour, sitting in his library, reading his books and wearing the Order of the Garter around his below his knee. And the truth of the man is he was up to his neck in the plot to assassinate the Medici in 1478. He was working for the Pope, and they were going to butcher the whole family, and then he was meant to bring his mercenaries in, once that had been done through the gates, and take over the city of Florence completely in a violent coup. So, yes, the painting is a wonderful example of purity and righteousness, and it's an example of absolute hypocrisy as well. The man was what James Delling Pole would call a wrong'un.
But now, I mean, armour has been part of human history, what, for thousands of years?
Oh, yeah.
How much has it changed?
Not a huge... Well, yeah, the shapes of it have changed. I mean, it's technology which has largely driven that change, because you have to be able to make large plates of iron or steel in the first place, which you can shape and then put them together in an armour. If you can't do that, you have to use very small pieces of metal linked together, and that's what mail is, what people will think of as chainmail. That's a form of armour that developed because you can make a mail shirt from lots of tiny pieces of iron or steel. Then, as time went on, they could produce larger and larger pieces in the 14th century, and you get what are called coats of plates. So these are leather or textile garments lined with iron or steel plates. So these are like flak jackets, but they're covered with very rich fabrics. They're very colourful. Then they can produce, with improvements in blast furnace technology, they can make bigger and bigger pieces until eventually you can forge a helmet out of one piece of iron or steel, and the same for a breastplate and the same for a backplate. And so that is what has created a lot of change in the shape. You then get fashion as well. You know, there were, in the same way that an Elizabethan doublet in the late 16th century is what's called a peascod. It's this big belly that dips right down towards the codpiece. Breastplates copied that shape. And the piece of armour worn over the thigh is called a tasset. And where the Elizabethans had what they called trunk hose, these sort of puffed out, again, we're straying towards Nancy Boy territory, but they had these very elaborate trunk hose, and the tassets were flared out to fit over the top of them. So,
and they were pink.
And yes, armors made in Greenwich were pink. So there you go. Perfect. This is so not only are we destroying the idea of the knight in shining armor, we're saying the knights there were Nancy boys. This is really going to disappoint those damsels in distress out there.
You can't say Nancy boys, though. It's Nancy them.
I don't know where that would fit on the gender spectrum.
Was armor only designated? Is designated the right word? Delegated to those in the military, or was it ever used just for fashion purposes?
Both. You had, in the military sense, you had every type of armor. You can compare it to cars. You had everything from a clapped out secondhand Fiat that was falling to pieces, you know, Fiat Panda, which would be the real cheap and nasty munition armor, and also some armor as it went out of fashion. If it wasn't broken up and reforged to make more fashionable stuff, it would go down the social scale. So you would find quite poor soldiers wearing what had once been quite fashionable pieces. But then you go up the scale to a nice BMW, to a nice Ferrari, an Aston Martin. You've got very high quality armor for the people that could afford it. So made by famous makers for famous clients. But also you had armor worn in a civilian context as decoration. The armor for the throat is called a gorget. And there are examples of people wearing gilded gorgets or even a collar of silvered mail, because they would gold plate armor and silver plate armor. And these would be worn as very elaborate forms of costume, if you like. But also, civilian clothing was armored inside. We know that Lorenzo de' Medici, for example, had a doublet. The description in the infantry is specific, lined with fine Milanese lames. In other words, it was meant to look like civilian clothing, so if somebody stabbed him, it would just be stopped by the armour. In fact, when the Pazzi conspiracy took place in 1478 and his brother Giuliano was killed, the member of the Pazzi family that came to take him from the Medici Palace down to the cathedral where the murder took place, he joked. He said, he'd been ill, and he said, "You're putting on weight, you're getting fat," and he gave him a hug. He squeezed him. He was checking he wasn't wearing armor underneath his clothing. So, and also, also they used to line hats with steel. Here's another expression for you. It's a secret. Keep it under your hat. Because they used to wear steel skull caps underneath hats as well.
That's really interesting. That must have been very uncomfortable.
Well, sometimes you get a lot of it in... certainly in the military context. In the civilian context, there's another piece in the Medici infantry, which is a beretta lined with steel plates. So it's the sort of hats that you see in the paintings of Botticelli or Ghirlandaio, the famous members of the Medici family. And they appear to be wearing civilian hats and civilian clothes, but that could be armor for all you know. That was the whole point.
So in those days, they would have used steel condoms.
Oh, you mean a cod piece, a thing called a braillette? Yes, yes. Listeners, if they get a chance to go to the Tower of London, you ask me these questions, you've got to...
So you're running out of closet space. The good news? You don't need to stop shopping. You just need to start selling with The RealReal. The RealReal is the world's largest and most trusted resource for authenticated luxury resale. Whether it's that mini bag that can't even fit your phone, or those boots you never fully broke in, The RealReal handles everything from photography and copywriting to shipping and pricing. So you can just sit back, get paid, and make room for things that actually feel like you. And with 10,000 plus new arrivals every single day from top designers like Prada, Celine, Louis Vuitton, and Loewe, all for up to 90% off retail, you're bound to find something perfectly on brand to fill that extra closet space with. Plus, right now, you can get an extra $100 to shop when you sell for the first time. Make room for what feels like you. Go to TheRealReal.com to start selling and get your extra $100 to keep shopping at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
Be ready for the answers, Jim. If you go and see what's called the Great Harry armor, which was made for King Henry VIII in 1540 in the Tower of London, it's got a whopper.
He definitely needed one.
Yes. it's a whopper, I can tell you.
His poor wives.
Yeah. Yes.
Armor is making a great comeback now. I mean, yeah. It's called robots.
Yes. Up to a point, Modern soldiers were, they had what they would regard as sacrificial limbs. They began going back to the idea of helmets and body armor, and over Kevlar flak vests, there would be these huge, heavy ceramic plates to stop the sort of high-velocity round that you could fire. But as you say, no, now that soldiers are becoming redundant, yeah, I'm sure that robots, robots and drones are being equipped with armor. Look at the drone netting that's being deployed. These are physical barriers to stop either missiles or the drones themselves.
Chris, I just want to circle back to something you said earlier, because I want to make sure that I don't sound stupid. But you took issue with the term blacksmith. So the people who made armor in medieval times, what were they called?
They were called armorers. The Italian
not
word,
blacksmiths.
Nope. The Italian word is corazzaio, a cuirass maker, but it applied to all types of armorers. In French,
could an armorer be a blacksmith, and could a blacksmith be an armorer?
Nope. The guilds were very strict.
Entirely different.
Yeah, entirely different. They might both use a forge and hammers, but the rest of the tooling they had would be very different. And the guilds would just stamp down on it if they tried to do that. You know, they'd find their workshops closed down and they'd be fined and thrown out the guild.
And would they have had status among the armorers? Like, for example, would people want to have gone to a particular armorer because he had a great name?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. People used to... people would serve apprenticeships, they would start at about 7 years. That shows you how long they had to study to actually be proficient in what they did. Sometimes apprenticeships could be as long as 15 years, and you would not be paid. The families would be absolutely chuffed to pieces that their kid would be apprenticed to a famous maker, because afterwards they know they'd have a job for life. So, yeah, it was quite a status thing.
And were blacksmiths and armorers rivals at all, or just basically like comparing a plumber to an electrician?
Not so much, but the relationship was more that the armorers kept an eye on what the blacksmiths would have been making. If anyone was going to start abusing the ability to use their forge to produce something, it would have been the blacksmiths. And any blacksmiths listening to this podcast are now going to be gritting their teeth. It's simply the way they thought at the time, that everyone trained to carry out a certain craft, and then they were meant to stay in their lane afterwards. And generally speaking, the guilds made sure their members earned a decent living.
I think what I'm trying to get at is, could a blacksmith be an armorer and vice versa? I mean, like, was one a PhD and the other just a straightforward bachelor's?
Again, you're tempting me to seriously rile any blacksmiths listening to this podcast. being a now retired master armorer myself, I'm going to have a very biased view of that. But blacksmiths have different skills. Blacksmiths forge weld, which is not a thing that armorers would generally do. Blacksmiths could produce much larger works of art than armorers. So I'm just going to just sidestep that question and say they're two different skill sets. How about that?
I have made a grand total of one knife, and it took me a whole weekend, and it was a huge amount of work. I can only imagine the amount of work that it takes to create armor. Is it just too exhausting?
I'm 63 now, and when I started, I was 23, and inevitably that takes a toll.
63?
Yeah.
You don't look a day over 70.
Thank you. You're always so kind when I come on your podcast, Joe. it wasn't... Right. When I started making this stuff, it was for the love of the material. And it's true. It's fascinating stuff. And you'll have heard me talking about it. Now, you know what an incredibly deep subject it is. But the principal mistake I made in my career was to go into restoration work. And while that was good for private clients and for museums, and the work I did for museums, you know, I worked on some absolutely staggering pieces. It also brought me into contact with the antiques trade. And whilst that can pay very well, the problem with that is a bag of rusty plates that were once an armour are worth, to be blunt, bugger all. If you can put those plates back together, you clean them up, you replace any missing plates, you give them a lovely surface finish, and then you mount that armour on a mannequin, and it looks absolutely fabulous, it's worth a lot of money. Sometimes a very, very great deal of money. And that means the incentive on the part of the dealers is to not say the pieces have been restored. And that, on the one hand, when I first began doing work like that, there is a sense of pride because you think, wow, look at, you know, because you are being challenged by the people that made the stuff originally. Your work has to be as good as the original, always, or it's going to look terrible. So you even learn to work in the styles of lots of different armourers and in different periods, in different materials. So there's a great sense of pride in it. But equally, you know, there's no getting away from it. Someone somewhere at the end of the line who could be buying that, not knowing it's been restored at all, and he's thinking, wow, look at this, fantastic, they're getting screwed. And so this did begin to take the shine off it. And it also, unfortunately, in that world, you meet some extremely unpleasant people because of the amounts of money involved. And it was when I decided to step back from certain clients, who I was being very well paid by, but treated like a slave, that really kicked off some nasty reactions. And because these people wanted me back in the field. And it's a thing which causes me problems to this day. But what happened was, and this is going to lead on to a much bigger subject, but bear with me. This did me a huge favour because these were some of my first faltering steps down the rabbit hole, because I began to see how the world actually works, and specifically with regard to what Freemasonry is about and the power they can wield. And that really was a massive wake-up call for me. So actually, because I'd moved to Italy by this stage, and because the scales were falling from my eyes, the people who were trying to make my life absolute hell to force me back, you know, just block any other work I was doing, to force me back into their service, they're not going to like what I'm going to say now. They did me a massive favour on two fronts. One, they drove me away from what's pretty toxic. You know, if you want to live your life and be honest and just be around normal people instead of people who are setting out to con people the whole time, it's a much healthier thing. But the thing which is really going to make them grind their teeth is this falling down the rabbit hole led me to avoid the vaccines. So thanks, guys. You did me a huge favour.
What's the Masonic link?
A lot of Masons in the antiques trade. A lot of dealers are Masons. And just in case...
Is that just coincidence?
No, money and power. They will go where the money and power is. And the people I've had the most trouble with actually control the antique arms and armor market. It's after a certain level, it's pretty much run as a ring. So the idea that it's all free competition and, you know, you can buy stuff from one dealer who's in competition against another. No, a lot of them work together. And they've even gone so far as to colonize, it works online. That's how they've come after me. But if you go into things like arms and armor chat rooms, Facebook groups, what a lot of the people in those groups don't realize is members of those groups are agents placed there by people in the antiques trade as runners. They're on the lookout for people who turn up original bits of armor. So even in chat groups, you have people working away quietly, and the people in those groups don't realize they've been infiltrated by the market. They're also doing their best to infiltrate museums as well.
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying is like a snapshot of just about everything else.
Yeah. What I've experienced, unfortunately, firsthand in the arms and armor world is a microcosm of what's going on out there in the world. It's the same thing. And
yes,
I'm politically speaking, on the, what you might call the dissident spectrum. I'm a nobody. I'm not giving any governments any grief. I'm not making anti-vaccine podcasts. I'm not doing any of that. But what I did was say no to some people who are connected to some extremely wealthy collectors. And that meant I was saying no to the collectors as well. And the upshot of that was you could call me the Mike Yeadon of the arms and armor world, because I got cancelled the same way he did. And that means being deranked by Google. It means all sorts of fun and games with having my the servers with my websites attacked, my webmail compromised. I've had the lot. And so when I've seen all sorts of guests in alternative media cropping up on podcasts like yours, like James Dellingpole, stories on UK Column, I began thinking, this is all horribly familiar. So, I came tumbling down this rabbit hole because of that, you know. So, again, to finalize the answer, it's what I think about that market now is it carries the stench of death with it. That's how I articulated it, because there are people that love these things because they're about war and they're about killing. They absolutely love possessing something. A sword, a Japanese sword, for example, would be signed by the maker on the Tang. It would also be signed by the tester. So Japanese swords could be tested on condemned criminals, and we have specified number of cuts, types of cuts, and those are chiseled into the Tangs. And there are people who get off on owning those weapons. And I don't want to be part of that world anymore.
But, I mean, if you're looking at armor in a museum, how do you know that it's the real thing?
I do. This is the whole point. I know from the shape. I know from the construction. I know from corrosion patterns. I know how metal should, after a certain stage, begin to delaminate, because these were handmade metals and they actually come apart in layers. And there are metallography studies done under the microscope of the crystalline structure of what real armor is actually like. So you can also carry out scientific analysis. Someone I know in the UK is the leading guy in the field. So I know everything there is to take apart a fake, which also makes me a deeply inconvenient to the arms and armor world. I used to do consultancy work for an auction house here in Italy. I'll be no more specific than that. And I was shown the door when they handed me a helmet and said, catalogue that for us, would you? And I just handed it straight back and said, I can't. That was made yesterday. I'm not catalogue. I'm not putting my name to that. And that's what they wanted me for. They wanted me to say, yeah, this is a genuine helmet, German, mid-16th century, da 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 da, fine. And I just said, no way. So that was it. Bye.
So I mean, it's organized crime.
Ooh. Now you're getting there. Yeah.
It's mafia. Gangs.
They are a mafia. That is absolutely true. Yeah. One of the few people I knew back in England. I have no contact with anyone in the field now. He used to describe all the dealers that turned up to the fairs he organised as the Brethren. And yeah, that's an apt name for them.
How can I find out more?
Right. Well, I know we've gone over time, but what I'd like people to do, instead of remembering me as that bloke that used to work on armor until the Freemasons caught up with him, is I now work on art history, and I publish books on art history. And if you go to my website, that's chrisdobson.it, Chris Dobson, all one word, .it, you'll find the books I produce there. You'll find the podcasts I'm now producing. I've written 3 books about the art and history of Florence to date, and there's a new one coming out, that one about the paintings about the Battle of San Romano that I mentioned earlier. That's coming out around Easter. So it'd be lovely if people would hop over to my website and they can find out all about me there. They can also find my podcasts on YouTube, Brighton, BitChute, Odyssey, you know, the usual suspects, and they can find me on Substack as well.
Chris Dobson, thank you for joining me in the trenches.